so much the faithfulness of so many of you and the audiences each night. We've had excellent crowds and the anticipation of what all of that can mean in terms of souls and eternity has to be a sense of joy. Not only to see someone come forward and saved here and to see the change in their life, but to see them in eternity experiencing all the pleasures and blessings of heaven, the joys that we share with them and seeing what they experience. I appreciate so much all of the many kindnesses that have been shown me. I appreciate the calls for putting up with me in a very, very congenial and pleasant hospitality and made it very, very pleasant. And I appreciate them opening their homes and the time to talk and be with Matt and the family. I appreciate Douglas for letting me have his bed. That's a pretty big gift. And I appreciate that. And I always appreciate being a Sewell. He always stimulates me, and he'd be on my list of most influential brethren that have had an impact on my life. And it is always a blessing to be with Sewell and Kenita. I must say the meals have been great, too, and the hospitality in all the homes has been just so pleasant and so good, and I appreciate the opening and the opportunity of being in your home. I tell you, I appreciate particularly with each of you the opportunity of sharing in your life. I believe there's a strong bond that develops between the teacher and the person who's taught, between the evangelist and the listener. And I know I have that bond for some people that stepped on my toes or pushed me back over the years. And I know that from this end, from the speaker's end, there's a deep part of that bond also that I feel it very, very consciously. And the opportunity to share in your work is such a great blessing, such an opportunity. And I want to express appreciation to the elders, and I want to express appreciation more to each one for the way that you have allowed me to stimulate and stir and benefit and learn and to be a part of your work. The singing's been edifying and spiritual. It's been appropriate and well done by the song leaders. I really appreciate the effort that they have put into it to make the worship what it should be. I'd like to start, and this is really a review. It's a closer, but it's a review. How many hours would you give for a soul? Someone may think I'm having to pray for the overhead to work there. The switch is down below. How many hours would you give for a soul? What would you pay? If you could take somebody to heaven with you, how many hours would you give? Would you give 10 to 25 to recommend spiritual things in the church here to 100 people this year? That's about what it would take with brief conversations here and there. Would you give 5 to 8 hours to associate with the better prospects and those who show some keen interest for them to watch you and determine if you're genuine and if you're for real? Would you spend 4 to 10 hours to teach them? Would you spend an hour or two to pray for them and to pray for their souls and to pray for your ability to teach and reach? Would you spend 10 to 30 hours to enfold? Because it takes a few hours to pull someone into the circle to where they know what's going on and they're part of everything and to include them in the family. Would you give 10 to 100 hours to teach the new convert? It might total up to 175. It might happen as quickly as 40 hours. But whatever the number, the total would be, would you give 175 hours for a soul? And when you review that and you say, well, I've got to do all these separate things, but 175 hours would be a small payment for an eternity of joy forever and evermore. Well, that looks back to some of the things we've stressed and taught this week. This evening, I want to stress the fact that there are some real difficulties, and those difficulties are overcome when we have that deep driving hunger where we have to care. And we're going to talk about some small things, because they are very subtle, and I'll remind you that we've talked about the commandment in Colossians, the 4th chapter, verses 3 through 5, to walk in wisdom toward them that are without. And that is, we are to find what's wise in our association with those who are lost. And that it takes some effort to find wisdom. Wisdom says, I love them that love me, and those that seek me early shall find me. And so, in these things, I think in many of these points I'm going to talk about tonight, I would have raised serious questions the first time I heard them. I did raise serious questions. But I watched and I went back and I reviewed and I've gone over them just again and again and gone through histories of churches, and they're valid. And the reason I would stress them is that they kill souls. They really are important as far as souls are concerned. There are some skills that we must develop, and we've talked about 2 Timothy 2:24. The sovereign Lord must not strive. This is not a matter of judgment or of opinion. This is a necessity. And we're commanded, we must be gentle unto all men, and we must be skilled in teaching. So we have to learn the skills that go with reaching out and converting others. Unfortunately, growth occurs rather fast. And it's rather exciting when you are growing. That means converting people. But it stops suddenly, is the normal pattern. It booms, and then all of a sudden it stops. And we don't know why. Our momentum has been exciting, but it's very, very difficult to regain. And so the thing that stops it is very important. We solve the essentials of growth and have fast growth, but that sudden stop at an unknown barrier is quite distressing. We may call it a correction, or we may call it a plateau, or we may call it a fuss sometimes. And we grow very fast and we hit some unseen barrier. And what we do is we cycle under that barrier till we finally understand that it's there and we solve what going on. Now, there are a couple of parts of that cycle. We go 10-15% cycles with good leadership. We go 15-20% fusses or stresses or difficulties if there's not good leadership. And we ask, why in the world would that be? It doesn't seem like that's the way that growth ought to occur. And I don't know why it's that way, except the best I could guess. And that you ought not to sort of put thoughts in God's mind and explain what God thinks, but the best I know is that God wants us to care enough that we'll find the way that works today. And then He expects us to have tender hearts and a pushing, driving concern where we have to find what works. And it doesn't mean we'll compromise the Word of God. And it doesn't mean we're going to go into some questionable activity. But it means that we're going to know what the law is, and we're going to know what matters of judgment are, and in matters of judgment, that we're going to be flexible. The sad thing about a barrier is that it stops visitor flow. And visitor flow is a little bit more susceptible to some small things, maybe than some other methods have been. It stops conversion. Barrier is often very, very subtle. It's hard to recognize. And it's hard to appreciate that it can stop growth. To appreciate these barriers, I'm going to ask that you try to put yourself in the shoes of a sinful person whose heart has become tender, and you started to look. And you're genuinely looking. But you don't know anything about any of these churches up and down the world, and you're not prejudiced for any of them or against any of them, and you're just out looking. And think like the unconverted, and think like the visitor that comes in. Unfortunately, I see some brethren who will not listen to the subtle messages that the visitor hears. There are brethren who set some standards of visitors that are really unrealistic, and they won't hear the messages. And they'll say, oh, I think we can do that, or they ought not to be that way. There are all sorts of ways that we excuse some of the judgments we make that the visitor's not ready to handle or that are beyond them. We see God's concern for something like that, 1 Corinthians, the 14th chapter, when they are speaking in tongues. And all are speaking in tongues, and that's creating a confusing kind of situation. Paul says, and there come in men unlearned in that tongue. They don't know the language. They're unbelieving. They're not Christians. And their reaction is important. That's immediately what he's concerned about. He says, will they not say that you're mad? That those people down there are crazy. Now, we must be aware of things that we do and the effect that it has on the visitor. We must feel what the visitor feels. And we must think from his standpoint if we're going to lead him gently through the steps that have to be there. Visitor flow starts where most of our baptisms come from seekers who are around good members. They're invited to visit. They're very skeptical, but they visit and check us out. But they're very sensitive to many things that we ignore, many things that we take for granted. A second problem, not only because we save most people through visitor flow, is most of us are in urban situations. And we're very urbanized, and we don't recognize how much we've changed within. Urban messages are very important messages. They're very small, very subtle messages. And business has to learn that, and we have to learn that also. Urban people know less about what's going on around them. For example, urban messages, those small unspoken messages, mean more to people when they know less about us. For example, cleanliness is more meaningful because that says something about what we think about ourselves. Upkeep, whether the grass is mowed, says something about what we think about the importance of our activity. Even light or color has suggestions and sets mood and creates feeling. And when somebody doesn't know and when someone is just beginning in their motivation, all of those do have an effect. You come in and the person who was cleaning the building that day on a volunteer schedule was a little busy and they didn't have time to wash the front door and they just sort of picked up and they didn't sweep, and half the women that come in feel sort of dirty when they see the fingerprints all over. And somebody drives by and the grass is deep and things are not kept up and nobody has gotten the leaves out of the corner. And they think, well, those people don't care very much about what they're doing. And that's because of the nature of urban messages. And you say, well, I don't know if God would be concerned about little things like that. And then, brethren, you get really upset. But you need to understand some scripture, such as 1 Corinthians, the 9th chapter, in verse 20 and 21. Paul says, and unto the Jews I became as a Jew. And he did this that he might gain the Jews, that he might convert some Jews. Now, would they be converted because he acted like a Jew? I don't think so. In the 21st verse, he says, to them that are without the law, as without law. In other words, to the Gentiles, he acted like a Gentile. Now, that doesn't mean that he went into the Gentile temple or that he worshipped in Jewish worship as a part of the Passover or the Feast of Tabernacles or something like that. He might make a moral of involvement to get remittance from some vows, but that's a moral issue and not a worship issue. And when he acts like a Jew, that can't mean very much more than he eats a Jewish diet and he wears Jewish clothing, which all has to be of the same material. And when he acts like a Gentile, he eats what Gentiles eat. And he dresses like a Gentile in modesty, but he dresses like a Gentile with Gentile clothing. It's just basically a change of clothing and diet and a few simple things like that. Well, why would he do that? He says he does that to save them. Now then, does that mean that that's going to motivate someone to become a Christian? No. But it does mean that if he were here with the Gentiles and he ate like a Jew and dressed like a Jew, it would be a barrier. It would put someone off. If he would go to the Gentile house and say, well, you shouldn't have really had pork with me coming. Or he has Jews over and he's trying to serve them pork. The point is that he would make very serious adaptations over small matters that would have some effect on the people that he wanted to reach. And when I asked the question, will food and clothing convert those people in Paul's day? No, but they could be a barrier. And I'm going to talk about some things. I've talked about seating already. Will seating convert people? Will parking convert people? No, it won't convert anybody. Can it push some people out the door down the street? I tell you, it can turn some souls away. And that's the seriousness of this message. That when we turn souls away, and we cause people to be lost, and we cause them to go to false teachers, then we have to recognize at least what we're doing, and that hungry heart has to hurt, and that deep concern has to be there. The sad thing is that some really seek transfers instead of conversions. There's an awful lot of thinking that talks about who's going to come in here, and Atlanta's in a great situation with transfers. There's a relationship between transfers and conversions that you would like. If you are going to baptize people, you're going to be doing the things that brethren want to be a part of, and they come in. Now, in that ratio, I'd love to see about 50-50. But really, in a lot of situations, in institutional churches, it's 80-20. In other words, 20 converts and 80% transfers. And there's a rule that you need to see with that, and that is you grow out of the weak, you swell out of the strong. The weak have to be taught and converted and changed and developed. The strong are already converted, and they already know. But when you are growing or increasing out of them, you're simply swelling. The emphasis on the weak would be seen by Paul in 1 Corinthians 9:22. To the weak became I as weak, that I might gain the weak. I made all things to all men, that I might by all means save some. That I have to think like the weak. And I have to recognize in areas where there is an option or a matter of judgment, I have to take them where they are to move them along. Now, the frightening thing about all that, when you grow out of the weak, you swell out of the strong, when you demand that the lost are strong to just begin looking, tell you what you're going to do, you're going to abort them. When you demand that they are able to take indifference, that they're able to ignore neglect, and that they ought to be here, you're laying another condition, just like those who warned people circumcised before they were saved would lay a condition down. And that concept of asking something from them that is too much, something that destroys them, is a terribly serious picture. Let me draw that picture for you. I preached a sermon on abortion some years back, and there was an old gentleman that was baptized that he came in, and he said he had been a reprobate, and he had done terrible things, and he wasn't proud of it. And two or three times he took me aside because of my naiveness about what was going on in the world, and he'd sort of fill me in on some of the things. And so he called me aside after the sermon on abortion. I don't always know why he does it. I suppose that he was wanting me to understand maybe some things that I might come across somewhere. But at any rate, he told me about the abortions that took place in World War II in Florence, Alabama, when little farm girls were coming into the factories, and there were men who were misleading them, and they would come up with a pregnancy, and then they would be looking for an abortionist. And there were three abortionists that practiced in Florence at that time. There was a doctor who did it on the side. He would have lost his license if it was known. He did a reasonable procedure, not reasonable in that abortion's ever reasonable, but medically what he did was as safe as it could be. Then there was a midwife, and she performed abortions. She didn't do as well as the doctor, but it wasn't terrible. But then there was an old butcher that he didn't care. And he would meet a young, frightened girl in a back room of an empty house somewhere and perform a violent and a terrible abortion. And maybe the girl's life was endangered when it was all over, and it was just a violent picture that was there. Now, let me tell you about spiritual abortions, and let me describe that. A spiritual abortion is destroying the soul before a new birth can take place. It's when somebody that's looking and is sincere and they want to change their life comes in, and some brother says something to them about their dress or about the too much facial hair, or he says something to them about some conduct, or and then there are a lot of other things. Or it's when we bring them down and put them on the front row the first time they come in and visit. An act of spiritual abortion is a violent action. It's killing the babe before they can be born again. And there's a real difference between physical abortion and spiritual abortion. In a physical abortion, the body dies, but the soul is saved. In the innumerable multitude of heaven, there are many of those beating hearts and brains that were active within the mother's womb that were destroyed that are going to be there. There are going to be those babies that were killed by drunken fathers, and those children in poor countries that were starved by some political dictator who was taking all of the aid and the food. The body dies, but the soul is saved. In a spiritual abortion, the sad thing is that the body continues for a while, but the soul is lost forever. And we have to understand the violence that we're talking about here. I've asked in workshops like this, from a low of 1 to a violent high of 10, how violent is a physical abortion? You just set the number. I often will get a 10. That a physical abortion and this helpless fetus, and you just destroy it. That's about as violent as you get. If that's violent, how violent is a spiritual abortion? And we have to be touched by the possibility that we may not care, that we may not hurt enough, and that we may not make the right choices. Does a congregation have the option of choosing to grow or choosing not to convert the lost? But there are some congregations that have chosen not to grow. That they are in a comfort zone and they're the right size and they don't want to grow. They don't want to get any bigger. The things I've talked about sometimes are suggestions and options, but does that mean that choices are unimportant and we can choose the options we personally prefer on our own base without regard to the effect that it will have on our evangelism? And quickly, let me note some of the barriers that are there. The first set of barriers are barriers of mood or attitude or effort. And there are other ways of saying this. This is just simply whether or not we really want to grow. And whether or not we want to grow enough that we'll make the tough decisions and make the efforts and the little changes that have to go on to learn how to do it, to learn how to receive them, to learn how to give the message of love and acceptance to them, to learn how to be patient, learn how to teach and include. Another way of saying it is that it is a barrier of desire or a barrier of vision. There, some brethren can't even see being any bigger. There are just all sorts of churches in this land that could just never imagine being twice the size of what they are. And if you can't see it, I'll tell you, you'll not work for it. You need to imagine it. You need to see Emory Hills baptizing a lot of people and the changes that would come from that. And I don't care what happens then, as long as you're all saved, but you need to see the conversions. There are churches that don't have goals. Or another way of saying it is that there's a barrier of little desire. There's a barrier of little hunger. There's the barrier of much satisfaction. Unfortunately, what happens when a congregation fills up and the singing is good and everybody's happy, is, man, wasn't that a great service tonight? And the singing was great and the crowd was just full. And what that does is it causes us to slow down on our hunger. That big comfort zone is a serious danger. And what growth does is it grows fast, and we are in a comfort zone and we fight to stay in that comfort zone. And when we go through that to the next level, it's a discomfort zone, but then there is a comfort zone there and we hang in it. And it's hard to break that ceiling to go on to the discomfort where we have to learn new things or do things differently and have a different kind of interaction that's there. Congregations have comfort zones. And I have observed that I think I know a couple of congregations whose comfort zone is 17. You know, if they've got enough people to lead the prayers and take care of the Lord's table, they're all right. And they just sort of settle in at that point. And we have a lot of expressions to justify that. And I've said some of these things. For example, it's just a common expression for brethren to say, "Well, I'll tell you, Brother Gomer, I think you can get too big." And I've said that. "I just think you can get too big." What are you talking about, too big? Too big for who? Too big for God? Does he say, "Hey, everything else, stop? You're running over heaven"? You see, it's too big for me. It's too big for my social comfort. It's too big for what I've imagined. It's not too big for God. Jerusalem twice was over 20,000, if we can trust the expressions and the words, and I think we can, that are there. They're just huge congregations, and when we say that, what we're saying is, well, some must have been wrong in Jerusalem, you know. We know that they were big in the first time, but all the apostles after in Acts 8, they were scared of all the apostles remained in Jerusalem. Man, that's a great opportunity for growth. You keep all your leaders, and you're going to grow. And they did grow. And they talked about when Paul came back, the myriads, the tens of thousands, it was a plural, it's a word for tens of thousands, in the plural of recent converts that they had. Was Jerusalem unwise? Was Jerusalem wrong? You need to rethink that. If you say, "I think we can get too big," I know you've got to go into another discomfort zone, but you're going to have a comfort zone up there. And you're not going to know everybody, but you're going to know 70, 80, 100, 150 people real well. You're going to have friends, and they may be in circles, but if you do what you knew, you won't be doing everything like you would be doing in a small congregation, but you'll be influencing as many or more people and in a more effective kind of way if that's what's necessary today. There are those who say, "Well, I tell you, I like a close group." Well, that assumes that big groups are not close groups. I don't care how big a congregation is. They can all be 20 if that's where we baptize the most people. But if we don't, then we better find out where we convert the lost and get about our business. Our business here is saving the lost. We're God's spokesman. And when we don't do that, when we take care of ourselves only, now we have to take care of ourselves. But when we only do that, we're not the Lord's church. We ought to take the sign off the building that we're here to save ourselves, to save our family, to save the brethren that are here, and save everybody else that we possibly can. Now, the expression about a close group is not as valid today as it once would have been. Most churches that are your size have already learned about going ahead and developing closeness in circles and in small ways throughout the congregation, and Dorcas and her caring and sympathy and the closeness that we see with the widows crying over her death is a picture of the kind of closeness is there. You don't go today without closeness. And then there are those that say, "I tell you, I'd just like to be involved more." Well, was there a big job and real involvement for the seven Greek names in Acts 6? Those names weren't doing everything, but they were doing an important job for the Grecian widows and for other widows possibly, whatever. But the point, you can be involved if you care and if you be interested and you reach out. The excuses that we sometimes give are really excuses to keep us in our comfort zone and say, "It's all right, you can get too big, you can lose your closeness," and that wouldn't be right. I'll tell you what wouldn't be right is to call ourselves the Church of the Lord, the Church of Christ, and not be as evangelistic as that hunger demands. But that's what would be wrong. And so when we look at our excuses and we face our situation, one of the things that happens is we move in to a very critical period of success. the crisis of success is a very real thing, and good congregations succeed. They grow rapidly and they hit that barrier. And then they've got tough decisions. Every decision you make when you succeed is tough. You've got serious options. And I'll tell you what almost all churches will do. They'll sit there and hope. They'll hope somebody will start another congregation. They'll hope that something will happen to take care of it. And they hope that an easy solution will come along. Finally, after they bounce that barrier a few times and things get a little troubled, then they say, man, we gotta do something. We gotta go on. And what can you do? Well, we'd all like to start a new congregation. I'll evaluate that in a moment. One of the tendencies is to tack on. But tack on, it sounds cheap, but the seats always are about half value, and you only get about half the crowd in there and get about half the lesson. You put them over here or something, and a tack on is really pretty expensive. You can build, but building's expensive. You can have two services, but there are some problems about two services. The temptation is to sit and hope. And maybe it'll just go away. Maybe something will happen. Is it an issue of souls? I think it's an issue of souls. And we need to see that when we are growing and converting people, and then we sort of stop with all that, and we back off or we ease off of that, that there are souls that are being lost, and we must be heard about that. There are some issues of starting a new congregation. And one of the reasons that I'll be so plain and straightforward about it is I like to see new congregations start. But it doesn't happen nearly as much today. And there are some reasons it does not happen. One, that people demand a higher level of leadership. But we only average about one elder to 100 people. If you just look, this is Ed Harrell's figure, across the board. And that means that to have enough elders, to have two elder types to go out and start a new group, to have the kind of leadership that people want, you've got to get well on up in numbers to have two that will spin off. And if you only have four, it's really hard to get them to decide to double their workload and split apart, and both of them have twice as much, both sets of elders have twice as much to do. We have leadership issues, and that's the major thing. You don't have great Bible classes when you start. And if you don't have great leaders, then people that are young and with children don't tend to go. And people drive further today, and they're just at ease with bigger congregations. Church out in Texas just last fall with 400 members ran a survey about starting a new group, and there were 52 people said they'd like to see a new group started. And 17 of them were ready to go. And out of 400 people, and there wasn't an elder type or a leader type, you know, that was going to pull in a lot of others and make them believe that they could quickly have great Bible classes. So there are problems and issues, and it's not happening as much today. There are people starting new groups, but they're not starting it with the kind of leadership where 100 people will leave a group and leave vacancy. You normally only lose, you know, 20 or 30, and at the most 40. And for a group like y'all, that's about a year, 2 or 3 years' time that you filled all that back up again. So that brings the problem of what do you do? The cheapest thing, the thing that keeps money going overseas and other places, is to do two services. And yet, there has been a period when we started a lot of new conservative congregations, and we weren't big enough to know about that, and so we've forgotten all of those lessons. And you don't want to do that permanently, but when you've got certain issues that are going on, you want to pay attention to the questions that are involved. It's a question of money first. It's the biggest savings that will ever happen in terms of keeping the momentum going for when you fill up to, if you can't immediately build, and sometimes you can't. There are different reasons, because of the money or because of code or things like that. Then you've got to say, well, are we going to sit here the way we are till we get through all the code and get all through all the other, and then we'll start out to save souls again. The issues, doctrinally, are pretty well answered by all the discussions on Sunday night communion and Bible classes. You have Bible classes? You've already divided in one way. Sunday night communion will answer some other questions. Their brethren say, well, how would you do that? Well, you may do it differently in different ways. The common way is you have a worship service early, and then you have about a 15-minute break, and brethren talk. Then you have a Bible class, and then another 15-minute break, and brethren talk. Then you have the late service. There are some rules that you have to keep. You've got to keep the services equal. If you get one service where the singing's better than the other one, then it's going to gravitate that way, and it's going to get out of hand, and it's going to be hard to bring visitors in. And the way you do that is you shift the time 15 minutes. You say, this is where we're starting, and if one service is a lot bigger than the other, then we'll shift that 15 minutes more uncomfortable until the services balance up. The issues are practical issues that are in the minds of people. One is the issue, well, I just know you'd have two congregations. Well, I go to congregations that have three doors in them, and you will have three congregations a lot more with three doors than you will with two services. In two services, you're all together in Bible class, you're all together Sunday night, you're all together on Wednesday night, and you're all together in your groups. And so you have the associations and ties, and you really don't develop two congregations. You won't do this permanently, but for those critical times when you need to be saving people and it is not possible within the physical structure, then that becomes important. Now, there's one thing you need to know, and that is there's an emotional roller coaster to do that. You would never do this without full awareness of what you're going to feel that first Sunday you come in here and half this audience is gone. Man, that's a shock. And that's depressing. Then you come back that night and everybody's here and the singing's great and Sunday night becomes your upbeat service. You got to come back the next Sunday morning and the singing's down. And it's going to take a little while to get over that roller coaster of depression. You're going to have to get some more visitors in there to get excited. But in 6 months, a year, then you realize, hey, look, here's 35 people we couldn't hide in the old building and or the old way. And so what happens is that depression turns to hunger. Now, I understand that most people haven't been through that. And most people haven't seen the places that are doing it. And I realize that most people don't do that. But I still think that when it is that important to money and that important to souls to keep up momentum, that it needs to be faced and addressed. One of the barriers is the barriers of facilities. And let me quickly go over that, because you need to understand some of the choices you have to make. There are barriers to growth in parking, and there are going to be brethren that say, well, I'll tell you, they're what they ought to be. They just park anywhere. They park over at Kroger and walk over here. And that's true, if they're what they ought to be. See, we're back to that same thing. We're demanding that they be strong people to come into Embry Hills. And you do that, you're going to abort the weak ones. You're going to abort the visitor. You're going to abort the one that's looking. And you need to understand when you shift the discussion from conversion to swelling. So parking barriers are what church growth people will tell you, the second most common limiting factor in churches increasing. You see, parking lots are filling up fast, and they're getting smaller. There are more cars per family. There are fewer riders per car. It's down from 4 to 3. Normally, you teach people that you figure 2 riders per car. Now, you all may be with your kids just above that, and you may be more a blast because you start saving a lot of money the more people you get in the car. And then there are just more space requirements that are there in the codes for catch basins and other things. It used to be on 1 acre. You could get a number of people in the auditorium. In the city congregation years ago, you had not have any parking and have 500 people in the auditorium. But by 1950, you were starting to evolve out of that. By 60, you were probably 1960, you get on 1 acre of ground, covered it with asphalt right up to the door, you get about 250 people with their riders per car. Now it's down to 150. In Florida, with a lot more easements and requirements, it's down to 93 people in the auditorium per per acre of ground. That's an average. And so that tells you how much is changing, and that tells you why it's becoming an issue. The second thing that why it's becoming an issue is you're different, and the visitor's different, because we're being trained by urban situations. How do you react at a full parking lot in the supermarket? You know, when you go into Kroger, and everything's full, and there's only one parking space around by the dumpster in the back. Do you take it, or do you go somewhere else? And they pull in here, and everything's full. What do? I tell you what they've done. They've driven out and gone somewhere else in places where I've been. So when do our guests arrive? Early or at the last minute? And what's the message that's given in a full parking lot? You say, well, I tell you, you're talking about a lot of money, and I guess you are. On small, developed urban lots, parking spaces can cost $3,000 to $5,000 each. Will you keep getting visitors without them? And the question is, are two souls worth $5,000? We're in an urban situation. You've got to gauge your own reactions. Now you say, well, I'm going to be there no matter what, and great. But what happens when you go somewhere and you are not going to be there, then you're just starting to look? The same set of characteristics are there about seating. And let me quickly run through those. First, there are messages about space that we see biblically, that the apostles can follow afar off, and the gospel writers can identify that. There's a reason for identifying that. That says something about what's going on. Their spacing is a message. The publican stands afar off. The Pharisee comes close. There's a message in space. The disciples of John, Jesus has to turn and speak to them. The unclean man goes through the streets crying, unclean, unclean, or leper, or leper. Christ, the Bible identifies, was crucified outside the city. The sin offering was taken outside the camp, a message in a location or a space or a meaning that's there. Seating rules are a very serious kind of thing. And let me just say a word of preference before I describe them. They're dominant and more absolute. First time I heard the seating rules, I doubted them, and I just thought, oh, there'll be a lot of exception. But in the 20 years or so, I've measured auditorium after auditorium. I've gone through histories of churches. And I tell you that the rules are frightening. There are reasons why they're frightening. They'll seem like there wouldn't be a reason, but there are reasons. I did a history of the church at Jackson Heights where I preached. There were three auditorium stages, and they going through the averages in attendance at every stage. The growth stopped within one of what the rule would say. At College View, they peaked out twice, and they peaked out within 1.5% of what the rule would say. The rules, they had 400 seats, they were only going to be 300, and that's what they were twice. But that's because of the way the rules are made and what goes on with that. Do you hear nonverbal messages when you go into auditoriums? Let me cite the rules first. These are based on 18 inches per seat. And that's an architect's definition. And I tell you, that's not fair for most of us. If you're going to be on a pew with me, by the time I get my size in there, you're being cheated. You better be a 14-incher or something like that. 18-inch, I've joked about skinny architects, but I don't know that I do that. I was up in West Knoxville last year or so, and just a really nice gentleman over here came up to talk to me afterwards, and he said, I'm an architect. Of course, he was skinny. And I be careful about what I say. But architects give you this narrow figure, and you just can't do that. You've got to figure 2 feet per person. That's what it averages. Now, a few times, if you've got a lot of kids, you can squeeze beyond that, but the seating rules start with 18 inches per person. You grow best from 50% full to 66% full, and then it starts slowing down, and it stops at 75%. The rate decreases from 66 to 75, stops at 75. Now, if you get too scattered, there's a negative kind of message that starts. 40% means no growth, 30% means approaching death. And I'd ask you, do you get messages out of auditoriums? Hear the nonverbal messages, or at least some of them. The auditorium's half filled. You think, boy, we got to fill this. And we can do it. It's not impossible. We need to fill these pews. At 66%, it's getting a little fuller and a little more crowded. At 75, everybody's on 2 feet. And that's even on the front row. And that doesn't leave very much spot for a family of five to come in. And so you say, you're doing great. You reach your comfort zone and you stay. If you go the other way, when you get it too scattered, the singing is heard, the contact is heard, a lot of things go on. 40%, you don't grow. At 30%, 9 out of 10 congregations are going to finally pass out of existence. You got a bunch of seats and a few people scattered all over that, and it's a rather depressing kind of situation. Well, that's really quick. And I don't expect you to believe all that the first time. I expect you to listen, and I expect you to think about it. I have great testing on all that, and it's very, very solid and very, very real and very, very important. Not because we care about comfort, but because we care about the souls that we want to reach. Let me give one final barrier that I would identify as the barrier of the dead horse. A horse was a great servant in my granddad's day. He served, my granddad had an old Fred that lived to be 27 years of age, and he was just like a member of the family. And when I was a kid, and I'd ride old Fred, Fred was smarter than I was. He knew how far down the road he was going to go with me on his back. He knew when he was going to turn around, and it didn't matter what I did and jerked.